Cassette 6, Side 2.
Chapter 42. Toshio.
No, Dr. Dart. The instatite inclusions are one part I'm not sure of. The static from the robot was really strong when I took that reading. If you'd like, I can double-check it right now.
Toshio's eyelids were heavy with ennui. He had lost track of time spent pushing buttons and reading data at Charles Dart's behest. The chimp planetologist would not be satisfied. No matter how well and quickly Toshio responded, it was never quite enough.
No, no, we haven't got time,
Charlie answered gruffly from the holoscreen at the edge of the drill tree pool.
See if you can work it out on your own after I sign off, okay? It would make a nice project for you to pursue on the side, you know, Toshio. Some of these rocks are totally unique. If you did a thorough study of the mineralogy of this shaft, I'd be happy to help you write it up. Imagine the feather in your cap. A major publication couldn't hurt your career, you know.
Toshio could well imagine. He was indeed learning a lot working for Dr. Dart. One thing which would serve him well if he ever did go on to graduate school was to be very careful in choosing his research advisor. The question was moot, with aliens overhead getting ready to capture them. Toshio shied away from thinking about the battle in space. It only made him depressed.
Thanks, Dr. Dart, but...
No problem,
Charlie barked in gruff condescension.
We'll discuss the details of your project later, though, if you don't mind. Right now, let's have an update on where the drone is.
Toshio shook his head, amazed by the fellow's tenacious single-mindedness. If it got any worse, he would lose his temper with the chimp, senior research associate or no. Toshio checked his gauges.
The bots descended a little over a kilometer, Dr. Dart. The shaft is narrower and smoother as we get down to more recent digging, so I'm anchoring the robot to the wall at each site.
Toshio looked over his shoulder to the northeast, wishing Denny or Jillian would show up as a distraction. But Denny was with her Kiqui, and he had last seen Jillian seated in lotus position, overlooking the ocean, oblivious to the world. Jillian had been pretty upset earlier when Takata Jim told her everyone at the ship was too busy getting Streaker ready for the move to talk to her. Even her questions about Tom Orley were brushed aside with abrupt politeness. They'd call her when they knew anything, Takata Jim had said before signing off. Toshio had seen a frown settle over her face as every call she made was deflected. A new comm officer had replaced Aki. The Finn told Jillian every person she wanted was unavailable. The one crew member she was able to talk to was Charles Dart, apparently because his skills weren't urgently needed at the moment, and the chimp refused to talk about anything but his work. Immediately, she had begun getting ready to leave. Then came orders from the ship, directly from Takata Jim. She was to stay indefinitely and help Denny Sudman prepare a report on the Kiqui. This time, Jillian took the news impassively. Without comment, she had gone into the jungle to be alone.
More of those tendrils of Denny's.
Charles Dart had been talking as Toshio's mind drifted.
The most exciting thing is the potassium and iodine isotope profiles. They prove my hypothesis that within recent geological time, some sophant race has been burying garbage in this subduction zone of the planet. This is colossally important, Toshio. There's evidence in these rocks of multiple generations of dumping of material from above and rapid recycling of stuff brought up by nearby volcanoes. It's almost as if there's been a rhythm to it, an ebb and flow. Something awfully suspicious has been going on here for a long time. Kithrop's supposed to have been fallow since the ancient Kerank lived here. Yet somebody's been hiding highly refined stuff in this planet's crust up until very recently.
Toshio almost committed a rudeness. Very recently, indeed. Dart was sleuthing in geological time. Any day now, the ETs would be down on them, and he was treating the alleged burying of industrial garbage thousands of years ago as if it was the latest Scotland Yard mystery.
"Yes, sir, I'll get on it right away."
Toshio wasn't even sure what Dart had just asked him to do, but he covered his ass.
"And don't worry, sir, the robot will be monitored day and night. Kipiru and Saud have orders from Takata Jim to stay plugged into it at turns when I'm unavailable. They'll call me if there's any change in its condition."
Wouldn't that satisfy the chimp? The Fen hadn't taken well at all to that order from Streaker's exec, but they would obey, even if it slowed Saud's work with the Kikui. Miracle of miracles, Charlie seemed to agree.
"Yeah, that's nice of them," he muttered. "Be sure to thank them for me. And say, maybe while Kipiru is plugged in, can he trace that intermittent static we keep getting from the robot? I don't like it, and it's getting worse."
"Yes, sir, I'll ask him."
The chimpanzee rubbed his right eye with the back of a furry hand and yawned.
"Listen, Toshio," he said, "I'm sorry, but I really need a break. Would you mind if we put off finishing this until just a little bit later? I'll ring you back after supper and answer all your questions then, hmm? Okay, bye then, for now."
Charlie reached forward and the holo image disappeared. Toshio stared at the empty space for a moment, slightly stunned. "Mind? Will I mind? Why, no, sir, I don't believe I'd mind at all. I'll just wait here patiently until either you call back, or the sky falls down on my head." He snorted. "Would I mind?" Toshio stood up, his joints crackling from sitting cross-legged too long. "I thought I was too young for that. Ah, well, a midshipman is supposed to experience everything." He looked toward the forest. Denny was hard at work with the Kikui. Should I bother Jillian, I wonder? She's probably worried about Tom. We were supposed to have heard from him early yesterday. But maybe she wants company. Lately he had started having fantasies about Jillian. It was only natural, of course. She was a beautiful older woman, at least 30, and by most standards quite a bit more alluring than Denny Sudman. Not that Denny wasn't attractive in her own way, but Toshio didn't want to think about Denny much anymore. Her implicit rejection, by effectively overlooking him when the two of them were alone, and so much alike, was painful. Toshio suspected she sensed his attraction to her and was overreacting by turning cold to him. He told himself that was an immature response on her part, but that didn't keep it from hurting. Fantasizing about Jillian was another matter. He'd had shameful but very compelling daydreams about being there when she needed a man, helping her overcome her loss. She probably knew how he felt, but didn't let it change her behavior toward him at all. It was a comforting forgiveness, and it made her a safe object of semi-secret adoration. "It could simply be that I'm very confused, of course," Toshio thought. "I'm trying to be analytical in an area where I have no experience, and my own feelings keep getting in the way. I wish I wasn't just an awkward kid and were more like Mr. Orley." An uneven electric tone behind him interrupted his fantasy, the calm coming back to life. "Oh, no," Toshio groaned. "Not already." The unit spat static as the tuner sought to bring in an erratic carrier wave. Toshio had a wild desire to run over and kick the thing into the bottomless murk of the drill tree shaft. Suddenly, a crackling, noise-shrouded whistle broke out. "If, crackle, midshipmen stuck together, who could stop us? And of midshipmen, who can fly like Calafians?"
"Aki!"
Toshio hurried over to kneel in front of the comm.
Right again, diving partner. Remember how we'd once hunt lobster?
Do I? Ifni, I wish we were home doing that now. What's happening? Are you having equipment trouble on the bridge? I'm getting no visual, and there's a lot of static. I thought you were taken off comm duty. And why the trinary?
Necessity is someone's crackle mother. I send this via close nerve socket. Anxious, I seek soft high patron, urgently, to pass crackle warning.
Tosho's lips pursed as he repeated the message to himself silently. Soft high patron. There were few humans given titles like that by Finns. Only one candidate was here on the island right now.
You want to talk to Jillian?
Urgently, to pass on warning.
Toshio blinked. Then he said,
I'll get her right away, Aki. You hold on.
He turned and ran into the forest, calling Jillian's name at the top of his lungs. Chapter 43 Aki. The monofilament cable was almost invisible against the rubble and ooze of the sea floor. Even in the light from Aki's harness lamp, it barely reflected a spiderweb's glimmer here and there amid the rock and sediments atop this jagged ridgeline. The cable had been designed to be hard to detect. It was the only certain way Streaker could communicate with her two outlying work parties without giving away her location. Aki had been forced to search for over an hour, using the best instruments at his disposal, and knowing where to look before finding the line to the island. By the time he had clipped his neural tap into the line, more than half of the oxygen in his breather was gone. A lot of time had been spent just getting away from the ship, and Aki wasn't even sure his departure had gone unnoticed. The taciturn electrician's mate in charge of the equipment locker shouldn't have questioned orders when Aki asked for breathing gear. Another Finn, an off-duty engine room rating, had followed him from a distance, and Aki had to dodge through the outlock to shake the Stenos off his tail. In less than 2 days, a subtle change had come over the crew of Streaker. A new alignment of power. Crew members who had formerly been of little influence now pushed their way to the front of the food lines and adopted dominant body postures, while others went about their duties with eyes downcast and flukes drooping. Rank and official position had little to do with it. Such things had always been informal aboard Streaker anyway. Dolphins were more apt to pay attention to subtle shifts in dominance than to formal authority. Now, even racism seemed to be a factor. A disproportionate number of the new figures of authority were of the Stenos subbreed. It amounted to an informal coup. Officially, Takata Jim was acting on behalf of the unconscious Crydike until a ship's council could be convened. But Streaker's water had the taste of a herd with a new dominant male. Those close to the old bull were on the out, and cronies of the new swam in the vanguard. Aki found it all quite illogical and disgusting. It bothered him that even the highly selected Fen of Streaker's crew could submit to ancient patterns of behavior under stress. He now saw what the Galactics meant when they said 300 years of uplift was too short for a race to fly starships. The rude realization made Aki feel more like a client than he ever had in the mixed egalitarian colony of Calathea. It gave a primitive satisfaction to his act of mutiny, abandoning the ship to make contact with Jillian Baskin against specific orders from the acting captain. Now Aki felt he knew the truth. He was a member of a crew of imitation spacemen. There was no way, short of Crydike miraculously recovering, that they were going to get out of this mess without intervention by their patrons. He discounted the value of Ignacio Metz, or Emerson Dianiti, or even Toshio, for that matter. He agreed with McAnee that their only hope lay in Dr. Baskin or Mr. Orley coming home. By now he had come to accept that Orley was lost. The rest of the crew believed this, and it was one more reason morale had gone to hell since Krydike's accident. The comm line quietly sent a carrier tone directly to his statoacoustic nerve as Aki waited impatiently for Toshio to return with Jillian. The line was not being used for anything else now that Charles Dart had signed off, but every second increased the chance that the comm operator aboard the ship would detect his tap. Aki had set it up to hide his conversation with Toshio, but even a dullard comsec Finn couldn't miss the side effects in time. "Where are they?" he wondered. "Surely they know I only have so much air, and this metal-rich water makes my skin itch." Aki breathed slowly for calm. A teaching rhyme of Kanik ran through his mind. "Past is what once was, a remnant that's called memory. In it lie the causes of what now is. Future is what will be, envisioned, seldom seen. In it lie results of what now is. Present is that narrowness, passing, always flickering, proof of the joke of what now is." Past, future, and present were among the hardest ideas to express explicitly in trinary. The rhyme was meant to teach causation as the human patrons and most other sophants saw it, while keeping essential faith with the cetacean view of life. It all seemed so simple to Aki. At times, he wondered why some of these dolphins of Earth had so much trouble with such ideas. One thought, one imagined actions, and their consequences, considered how the different results would taste and feel, then one acted. If the future was unclear, one did the best one could, and hoped. It was how humans had muddled through during the ages of their horrible orphaned ignorance. Aki saw no reason why it should be so hard for his people, especially when they were being shown the way.
"Aki? Toshio here. Jillian's coming. She had to break away from something important, so I ran ahead. Are you all right?"
Aki sighed. "In the depths, with itching blowmouth, I tread in wait at duty's calling, as the cycloid rolls in."
"Hang on,"
Toshio called, interrupting the rhyme. Aki grimaced. Toshio never would develop a sense of style.
"Here's Jillian," Toshio finished. "Take care of yourself, Aki."
The line crackled with static. "You too, diving flying partner."
"Aki?"
It was the voice of Jillian Baskin, made tinny by the weak connection, but almost infinitely gratifying to hear.
"What is it, dear? Can you tell me what's going on the ship? Why won't Krydike talk to me?"
That wasn't what Aki had thought she would ask first. For some reason, he had expected her main concern to be Tom Orley. Well, he wasn't about to bring the subject up if she didn't. "McAnee, patient healer, sends me out with danger warning. Soundless, flukeless, lies Krydike, Streaker's fortunes strangely whining. And the taste of atavism fouls the waters." There was silence at the other end. No doubt Jillian was formulating her next question in a way that would let him answer unambiguously in trinary. It was a skill Toshio sometimes sadly lacked. Aki brought his head up quickly. Was that a sound? It hadn't come from the comm line, but from the dark waters around him.
"Aki,"
Jillian began,
"I'm going to ask you questions, phrased to take three-level answers. Please spare artistry for brevity in answering."
"Gladly, if I can," Aki thought. He had often wondered why it was so hard to hold direct conversations in trinary without beating around the bush in poetic allusion. It was his native tongue as much as Anglic was, and still he felt frustrated by its resistance to shortcuts.
Aki, does Crydike ignore the fish of dreaming? Does he chase them, or does he feed them?
Jillian was asking if Crydike still functioned as a tool user. Was he lost to injury, drifting in an unconscious dream hunt? Or, worse, was he dead? Somehow, Jillian had immediately gone right to the heart of the matter. Aki was able to answer with blessed brevity.
Chasing squid in deepest water. There was that sound again, a rapid clicking, coming from not far away.
Cursed the necessity to keep his neural socket linked to the static of this line. The sounds were close enough to leave little doubt. Someone was hunting for him out here.
All right, Aki. Next question. Does Hikahi calm all with her kinink rhythms? Does she echo herd obedience, or does she sing an absent silence?
Dolphin sonar is a highly directional thing. He felt the edge of a lobe of a sonic beam pass just above him without hitting him broadside. Aki got down as close to the ocean floor as he could and made an effort to direct his own nervous clickings into the soft sand. He wanted to reach out with one of his harness arms and grab a rock or something for stability, but was afraid the tiny whirring of the motors would be heard.
Absent silence fades the memory of Hikahi. Absent silence from Tisht and Suesi.
He wished he, too, were absent this place and back in his quiet stateroom aboard Streaker.
Okay, is their silence that of netted capture? Is it of orca fearful waiting? Or is it the silence of fishes feeding?
Aki was about to answer, when, like one whose eyes were suddenly struck by a bright light, he was awash in a beam of pulsed sound, highly directional, somewhere from his left and above. No question, a dolphin up there was instantly aware of him.
Takata Jim bites the cables. My own job is mine no longer. His fen relay, his lying songs.
Aki was so agitated that some of that actually came out as sound rather than impulses sent to the monofilament. There was no use trying any longer for secrecy. He made ready to jettison the line and turned his melon toward the intruder. He fired off a sonar pulse strong enough, he hoped, to momentarily stun him. The echoes of his burst returned, giving him a vivid image. There was a thrashing sound as a very large dolphin swung aside out of his beam.
Kathad John!
Aki recognized the echo at once.
Aki? What was that? Are you in fighting patterns? Break off if you have to. I'm coming home fast as I...
Duty absolved, Aki popped the neural link free and rolled to one side. He acted none too soon. A blue-green laser bolt sizzled through the spot where he had been seconds before. So that's the way of it, he thought, as he dove into the canyon next to the ocean ridge. The hammerhead is out to get me, and no politeness about it. He did a quick roll to his right and speared downward toward the shadows. Dolphins were known for a reluctance to kill anything that breathed air, but they were not a limited race. Even before uplift, humans had witnessed cases of fin murdering fin. In enabling cetaceans to be starfarers, men had also made them more efficient when they chose to kill. A line-bright laser beam hissed a bare meter ahead of him. Aki clenched his jaw and dove through the streak of scalding bubbles. Another narrow, searing bolt sizzled between his pectoral fins. He whirled and dove for the long sonic shadow of a jagged outcrop of rock. Kathad John's laser rifle could kill at long range, while the welder torch on Aki's harness was, like all sidearm tools, of use only up close. Obviously, his only chances were in flight or in trickery. It was very dark down here.
All of the red colors were gone. Only blue and green could pass through from the day to illuminate a shadow-filled landscape. Aki took advantage of the rugged terrain and slipped between the sharp walls of a narrow rock cleft. There he stopped to wait and listen. The echoes he picked up through passive listening only told him that G'thaa John was out there, somewhere, searching. Aki hoped his own rapid breathing wasn't as loud as it seemed. He sent a neural query to his harness. The microcomputer in its frame told him he had less than half an hour's air left in his breather. Aki's jaws ground together. He wanted G'thaa John's long pectorals between his teeth, much as he knew he was no match for the big Stenos in size or strength. Aki had no way of knowing whether G'thaa John was out here on his own or following orders from Takata Jim. But if there was some cabal of Stenos at work, he wouldn't put it past them to kill the helpless Crydike to secure their plan. Unthinkable as it was, they could even get it into their heads to harm Jillian, if she weren't careful how she made her return to the ship. The mere thought of any Finn participating in such crimes made Aki feel sick. I've got to get back and help McAnee defend Crydike until Jillian arrives. He slipped out of the cleft and swam a series of floor-hugging zigs and zags toward a small canyon to the southeast, in a direction away from Streaker and away from both Toshio's island and the Thenanin wreck. It was the direction most likely to be unwatched by G'thaa John. He could hear the giant casting about for him. The powerful beams of sound were missing for now. There was a good chance he would get a head start. Still, it wasn't quite as tasty as the satisfaction he would have felt in surprising G'thaa John with a snout ramming to his genitals. Jillian turned from the comm set to see anxiety on Toshio's face. It made him seem very young. Gone was the role of a rough, tough, worldly Mel. Toshio was an adolescent midshipman who had just found out his captain was crippled. And now his best friend might well be fighting for his life. He looked at her, hoping for reassurance that everything would be all right. Jillian took the youth's hand and pulled him into a hug. She held him, against his protests, until at last the tension went out of his shoulders, and he buried his face in her shoulder, holding her tightly. When he finally pulled away, Toshio didn't look at her, but turned away and wiped at one eye with the heel of his hand. "I'm going to want to take Kipiru with me," Jillian said. "Do you think you and Saot and Denny can spare him?" Toshio nodded. His voice was thick, but he soon had it under control. "Yes, sir. Saot may be a problem when I start giving him some of Kipiru's duties, but I've been watching the way you handle him. I can manage." "That's good. See if you can keep him off Denny's back. I'm sure you'll manage fine." Jillian turned to her small poolside campsite to gather her gear. Toshio went to the water's edge and switched on the hydrophone amplifier that would signal the two dolphins that they were wanted. Saot and Kipiru had left an hour ago to await the evening foray of the Aborigines.
"I'll go back with you if you want, Jillian."
She shook her head as she gathered her notes and tools together.
"No, Toshio. Denny's work with the Kikwi is damned important. You're the one who's got to keep her from burning down the forest with a spent match while she's preoccupied. Besides, I need you to maintain a pretense that I haven't left. Do you think you can do that for me?"
Jillian zipped shut her watertight satchel and started slipping out of her shirt and shorts. Toshio turned away at first, and started to blush. Then he noticed that Jillian didn't seem to care that he looked.
"I might never see her again," he thought. "I wonder if she knows what she's doing for me."
"Yes, sir," he said. Toshio's mouth felt dry.
"I'll act just as harassed and impatient as ever with Dr. Dart. And if Takata Jim asks for you, I'll tell him you're off
somewhere, sulking.
Jillian was holding her dry suit in front of her, preparing to step into it. She looked up at him, surprised by the wryness of his remark. Then she laughed. In two long-legged strides, she was over to him, seizing him into another hug. Without a thought, Toshio put his arms around the smooth skin of her waist.
"You're a good man, Tosh," she said, as she kissed him on the cheek. "And you know, you've grown quite a bit taller than me. You lied at Takata Jim for me, and I promise we'll make a proper mutineer of you in no time at all."
Toshio nodded and closed his eyes.
"Yes, ma'am," he said, as he held her tight.
Chapter 44 Crydike. His skin itched. It had always itched since that dim time when he rode alongside his mother in her slipstream, when he had first learned about touch from nursing, and the gentle nuzzle she used to remind him to rise for air. Soon he had learned that there were other kinds of touching. There were walls and plants and the sides of all the buildings of the settlement at Catalina Under. There was the stroking, butting, and yes, biting play of his peers. There was the soft, oh, so deliciously varied touch of the Mels and Femmes, the humans who swam about like pinnipeds, like sea lions laughing and playing catch with him underwater and above. There was the feel of water, all the different kinds of feel there were to water. The splash and crash of falling into it, the smooth laminar flow of it as you speared along faster than anyone ever could have gone before. The gentle lapping of it just below your blowmouth as you rested, whispering a lullaby to yourself. Oh, how he itched. Long ago he had learned to rub against things, and he discovered what that could do to him. Ever since then he had masturbated whenever he felt like it, just like any other healthy Finn would. Crydike wanted to scratch himself. He wanted to masturbate. Only there was no wall nearby to rub against. He seemed unable to move, or even to open his eyes to see what surrounded him. He was floating in mid-air, his weight held up by nothing, by a familiar magic, anti-gravity. The word, like his memories of floating this way many times before, for some reason felt alien, almost meaningless. He wondered at his lassitude. Why not open his eyes and see? Why not click out a sound beam and hear the shape and texture of this place? At intervals, he felt a spray of moistness that kept his skin wet. It seemed to come from all directions. He considered and came to the conclusion that something must be very wrong with him. He must be sick. An involuntary sigh made him realize he was still capable of some sound. He searched for the right mechanisms, experimented, then managed to repeat the faint moan. "They must be working to fix me," he thought. "I must have been hurt, but I don't feel any pain. I feel a vacancy. Something has been taken from me. A ball, a tool, a skill. Anyway, the people are probably trying to put it back. I trust people," he thought happily. And the apex of his mouth curled into a slight smile. The apex of his mouth did what? Oh, yes, smiling. That new thing. New thing? I've done it all my life. Why? It's expressive. It adds subtlety to my features. It is redundant. Crydike let out a weak, warbling cry of confusion. In the brightness of the sunshine, answers swarm in schools like fishes. He remembered a little now. He had been dreaming. Something terrible had happened, plunging him into a nightmare of bewilderment. Shapes had darted toward and away from him, and he had felt ancient songs take new eerie forms. He realized he must still be dreaming,
with both hemispheres at the same time. That explained why he couldn't move. He tried to coax himself awake with a song. Levels there are, known only to sperm whales, by cedar who hunts in chasms of dreaming, to battle the squid, whose beaks are seamounts, and whose great arms encompass oceans. It was not a calming rhyme. It had overtones of darkness that made him want to fly away in horror. Krydike tried to halt it, fearing what the chant might call up, but he could not stop crafting the sound glyphs. Go down to levels in the darkness where your cycloid never reaches, where all music finally settles, and it gathers stacked in layers, howling songs of ancient storms and hurricanes that never died. A presence grew alongside Krydike. A great broad figure could be felt nearby, forming out of the fabric of his song. Krydike sensed its slow sonar pulses, filling the small chamber he lay within, a small chamber that couldn't possibly hold the behemoth taking shape beside him. Nukupai? Sounds of earthquakes stored for epochs, sounds of molten primeval rocks. The sound creature solidified with each passing verse. There was a muscular power in the presence forming beside him. The thing's slow, huge fluke strokes threatened to send him tumbling head over tail. When it blew, its spume was like a storm breaking on a rocky shore. Fear at last gave Krydike the will to open his eyes. Moist mucus flowed as he labored to separate the lids. The sockets were recessed to their deepest, and it took moments to make them switch to air focus. At first, all he saw was a hospital suspension tank, small and confined. He was alone. But sound told him he was in the open sea, and a leviathan rode next to him. He could feel its great power. He blinked, and suddenly his vision shifted. Sight adopted the frame of reference of sound. The room vanished, and he saw it. The thing beside him could never have lived in any of the oceans he had known. Krydike almost choked in dread. It moved with the power of tsunamis, the irresistibility of tides. It was a thing of darkness and depths. It was a god. K-k-k-k-k-k-f-cree! It was a name Krydike hadn't been aware he had known. It welled up from somewhere like the dragons of a nightmare. One dark eye regarded Krydike with a look that seared him. He wanted to turn away, to hide or die. Then it spoke to him. It spurned Trinary as he knew it would. It cast aside primal, disdaining it a tongue for clever animals. It sang a song that brushed against him with physical force, enveloped him, and filled him with a terrible understanding. You swam away from us, Krydike. You were starting to learn. Then your mind swam away. But we have not finished yet. We have waited long for one such as you. Now you need us as much as we need you. There is no going back. As you are, you would be a hulk. Dead meat, emptiness without a song, never again a dreamer or a fire user. Useless, Krydike, neither captain nor cetacean, useless meat. There is one path for you, through the belly of the whale dream. There you may find a way, a hard way, but a way to do your duty. There you may find a way to save your life. Krydike moaned. He thrashed feebly and called out for Nukupai. But then he remembered. She was one of them. She waited down below with his other tormentors, some of them old gods named in the sagas, and some he had never heard mentioned even by the humpback whales. Cree, had come to bring him back. Though Anglic was lost to him, Crydike conveyed a plea in a language he had not known he knew. I am damaged. I am a hulk. I should be dead meat. I have lost speech. I have lost words. Let me die. It answered with a sonorous rumble that seemed born beneath the earth, beneath the ooze. Through the whale dream you go, where your cousins have never been, even when they played like animals and barely knew men, deeper than the humpbacks go in their idle meditation, deeper than Feister, in his devil hunt, deeper than the darkness itself. There you may decide to die if truth cannot be born. The walls of the small chamber faded away as his tormentor began to take on a new reality. It had the great brow and bright teeth of a sperm whale, but its eyes shone like beacons, and its flanks were streaked with sparkling silver. All around it shimmered an aura like the glimmering fields around a starship. The room disappeared entirely. Suddenly, all around him was a great open sea of weightlessness. The old god began to swim forward with powerful fluke strokes. Crydike, wailing a soft fluting cry, was powerless to prevent being swept along in the behemoth's pulling slipstream. They accelerated faster, faster. In spite of the absence of direction, he knew, somehow, they were going down.
Did you hear that?
Nakani's assistant looked up at the tank in which the captain lay suspended. A dim spotlight within the gravity tank shone on the suture scars of repeated surgery. Every few seconds, recessed nozzles cast a fine mist over the unconscious dolphin. Nakani followed the medic's gaze.
Perhaps... I thought I picked up something a little while ago, like a sigh. What did you hear?
The assistant shook her head from side to side.
I'm not sure. I thought it sounded like he was talking to somebody, only not in Anglic. It seemed like there was a snatch of trinary, then something else. It sounded weird.
The assistant shivered.
You think maybe he's dreaming?
Nakani looked up at Crydike.
I don't know dreaming is something to wish for him, or to pray devoutly he doesn't do.
This ends side 2 of cassette 6